This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. You know, some of y'all never been down south too much. You know, down there, we got a little plant.
Down where, you ask? You know where.
And it grows on a tree. And it looks kind of like a turnip green. But everybody calls it poke salad. Now, Nick, that's poke salad. Nick, you ever had poke salad?
I've never had it. I've never had the poke salad. I can't believe you burned that, seeing as how we could have used that later in the show, but never.
Who's to say we still can't? Lazy. That's never been a consideration for us. Why would we start considering that now? We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me is my my Southern-born and Southern-bred and probably sooner than he'd like, he'll be Southern dead, friend.
I don't know about sooner than I'd like. It'll probably be welcome by the time it comes.
We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Welcome to a new edition. It's been an interesting week in Hard Travelerville. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should mention, of course, that the award-winning WWE Network redesign has brought newfound attention to the namesake of our plaza that we're currently
yes.
in. Ho-Ho Loon Plaza.
He's got his very own profile page on the WWE Network now. So go out there, folks. Type it into your search bar on the new and improved network. Ho-Ho, that's one word, Ho-Ho Loon, L-U-N. And you will be, I think you'll be amazed and captivated at what you find.
I think you will be, too. His full biography is on there. Mm-hmm. His height, his weight, his finishing holds, you know.
And we, of course, were alerted to this because we heard a faint noise, a beeping noise coming from the storage closet here, because for the first time in nigh on many months, the Ho-Ho Loon ticker was activated and awake.
It really was. You know, I'll be honest, the first time I heard it, Nick, I thought it was a bomb that was ticking and about to explode our offices. Mm-hmm. And I got briefly concerned with my lack of speed. I was thinking, gosh, I don't think I'll be able to get it out of here on time. So I was trying to calculate my method, but then luckily Nick went over and opened the closet, and he saw that it was the ticker. So,
it's just this thing.
Yeah, and so we're happy to alert you that Ho-Ho Loon is alive and well, and now being featured, perhaps to a rebirth of excitement in the Ho-Ho Loon rebirth. Nick,
oh, wouldn't that be awesome? But also, it's been an interesting week in the world of the podcast as well, because
yes. You
know, folks, we had a script that was ready to go for this week's podcast, and then at the last minute, Greg, being the man that he is, called an emergency meeting and demanded an entire rewrite of this week's show from the ground up. And me, you know, I'm usually the lead creative force here behind this here show, and I'm usually the one who is responsible for all the quality ideas that you hear each and every week. And I was reduced to the role of nothing more than a glorified typist, according to what some people say. So it's been a week of ego stroking here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Quite frankly, I'd suggest that I'm still signing the paychecks around here. And
the paychecks for $0 and 0 cents.
What I say ultimately goes. So if
I
want to rewrite the show,
we did get those Amazon cards at one point. What are we averaging at this point, Greg? About a penny a podcast?
Something like that. But regardless, you have to write checks just to, you know, make sure that you're in a legit business, even if they are for $0 and 0 cents. Just ask WCW with their merchandise checks. So, yes. Yeah, so what we're doing is, as you guys know, we had a long-running series, a long-running weekly episodic series. We had a monthly series that we were doing for a long time called Hard Travelers for Hire. And this, of course, is where we went movie by movie through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Well, as of May, with the release of Avengers Endgame, we wrapped up our journey through the MCU. We had a wonderful panel of guests that we would recommend you to go and listen to as we sort of put a bow on Hard Travelers for Hire. Then we knew that in our mind's eye that we had to have something to replace Hard Travelers for Hire. We batted around some ideas. Now, we bought ourselves some time with theme months in June and July. June, July, in fact. Yes. What would we have? In June, we had X-Men month, X month, if you will. And in July, we had Spider month. Mm-hmm. Well, now, and of course, May was Avengers month. So now
April was Shazam month.
That's right. So we are currently, and then March was Captain Marvel month, right?
It was.
Yeah. So, but now we've run out of theme months for the time being. And so we have to come up with a new series. And we batted around some ideas. We talked about going through the DC animated universe, but we decided that would take forever. We'd never get it finished. Then we thought about going through the DC live action movies. And we realized that due to some changes that will be coming to the show after episode 200, that wouldn't be a good idea either.
Let's not tell tales out of school just yet.
No, we're not. We're not getting ahead of ourselves, Nick. But the point being, we had originally decided, I don't remember what we had originally talked about doing for this, but a genius idea hit me the other day. Maybe not a genius idea. It may turn out to suck.
The thing we had most recently settled on was we were going to do a look back at the live-action Fantastic Four movies that have been produced. And that's not necessarily disqualified with what we transferred to.
So instead, the idea that we came up with is, and this is sort of a pilot episode for it. We'll see how it goes. But it's one that I'm kind of excited about. A series that for now has the title Fix It or Forget It. And the idea of this is we're going to take a look at some of the worst comic book movies of all time. These are the movies that are critically panned, box office bombs, movies that are universally reviled in the pantheon of comic book film. And we're going to take a look at these movies, watch them with fresh eyes, and very simply, whether this movie can be fixed or could have been fixed or whether it never should have been made in the first place. So, for an example, we'll watch a movie, and if we do decide that this movie could have been fixed, we will lay out the ways that we would fix it. And if we decide just forget it, then we will explain why this movie was such a bad idea that it never should have happened, and they should have gone right back to the drawing board and started from scratch. So that's sort of our premise. And to get us started, we decided to kick things off with a movie that a lot of people have forgotten even happened. It was a 2010 DC Comics movie.
2010, DC. My God.
Yes. And it is an adaptation of DC's most famous Western hero. That's right. One of the only, to my knowledge, comic book Western that had ever been made to this point. And it is called Jonah Hex, appropriately enough. It's about the famous gunslinger from DC Comics, Jonah Hex, the bounty hunter, former Confederate soldier, half-blood Indian American who travels the country collecting bounties, getting into trouble, getting into fistfights, etc., and battling always with his conscience and the list of bad things that he's done in his life. So this sounds pretty awesome to me, on paper. I was really excited when this movie was announced.
Yeah, you're a bit more familiar and a bit more of a fan of the character of Jonah Hex than I am. I'm primarily familiar with him through his brief animated appearances that he's made throughout the years. And you, meanwhile, have actually read some more of the comics, which makes a little sense because that's one thing about you. You are a much bigger fan of the Western genre of film than I am.
Yes, I'm a big Western fan. I grew up watching Westerns with my dad. I still watch Westerns when they come out. They don't make them much anymore. I grew up on the Eastwood Westerns and everything under the sun, Lonesome Dove, all that stuff. So I'm a big fan of the genre. I think when it's done well, it's one of my two or three favorite genres of film. but they've kind of died out in popularity in the last 20 years or so. You don't see a lot of Westerns. You certainly don't see a lot of popular Westerns. So
what was the last Western to hit big? True Grit, I guess? The True Grit remake?
True Grit, probably, which was a Coen's movie. I think you could argue the Magnificent Seven remake with Denzel was a pretty big success.
But Hateful Eight with Tarantino. I mean,
Hateful Eight, although not to the same. I don't think that permeated pop culture the way that something like Tombstone did.
But it made money, at least, and it was a high profile project from a high profile creator. You know,
absolutely.
In a time,
Django
Unchained.
Django, yeah, that was another good example. Tarantino's kind of keeping Westerns alive in his own way, even through his newest one, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is kind of a Western at times in its production, not even though it's set in the 60s, but I'll let people determine that when they see the movie. So the idea of the popular genre of Western is kind of gone. You don't see a summer movie season where you've got two prominent Westerns coming out, you know? I know some really good Westerns that didn't do very well at the box office. Kevin Costner had a couple in the 2000s. And so it's not the genre that it was, say.
That one with the really long title that I haven't seen?
Yeah. You're talking about the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford?
Something like that.
That was a Brad Pitt one. That one actually wasn't very good. I watched that one. Mm. But 25, 30 years ago, it would have been a different thing to make a Western movie. But now, in 2010, a little bit bold to come out with a Jonah Hex movie because Westerns were not in vogue. And there had been some big prominent flops, like probably the movie that this gets compared to the most, Will Smith's Wild Wild West. it was a big flop, notoriously. Mm-hmm. Cowboys and Aliens, which I'm not sure if that came out before or after this, but that was a flop. So, you know, it's an interesting choice. So we're taking a look at Jonah Hex, and we're going to talk more about it. But what we're going to do is, similar to Off the Page, we're going to let this movie play in the background. We're not going to watch the whole thing. But we're going to let this movie play in the background while we discuss whether we can fix it or whether we should just forget it. So with that being said, I'm going to count everybody down. We've got it pulled up on HBO Go on streaming. If you have HBO, it is on there, so pull it up. And we're going to start it in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play. And 2010, a Western, I can see it being a bit of a tough sell. So there are a few, shall we say, compromises made here, Nick, from the concept of simply making a Western-based hero.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah. So to start out with, this movie is directed by Jimmy Hayward, who I had never heard of before doing this show, and he doesn't have an extensive history as a director. He was an animator on the show Reboot, if you remember that, from the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. He also was an animator on Toy Story, A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., and Finding Nemo. He later became a sequence director on a film called Robots that I don't remember happening.
It was a CGI movie, apparently. I remember it.
Yeah. So his first foray as a director was Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. And so he followed up with four times
in the last like 2 months.
Then he followed that up with Jonah Hex. And then he had a 2013 film called Free Birds. And that's the last thing he's done as a director. So this guy doesn't have a strong reputation.
That was also an animated film. My Lord.
So Jonah Hex may be his only live action. And even his Wikipedia page lists him as a Canadian-American film director, screenwriter, animator, and guitarist.
Mm.
So not a strong pedigree. And the screenwriters here are Mark Neveldine and Brian Taylor. Now, what are they known for? They're known for the Crank series. They are the writers and co-directors of Crank and Crank High Voltage.
So, also, wait a minute.
Also the movie Gamer.
I just put this together. Aren't they the guys who got the Ghost Rider sequel then?
Yes, they also directed Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance.
My Lord.
So back to back.
Somebody let them make this and then let them make another comic book movie. My Lord.
Yep. They had back-to-back movies with Jonah Hex and Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance. Now, in fairness, they did not write Spirit of Vengeance, but they did direct it. And they wrote this one but didn't direct it. But still, I think if you watch this movie, Nick, it's clear that there's this Crank influence on it. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I think later in the movie, if you're going to watch it with us, which I would advise not doing, it is going to have a lot of hyper-fast cuts, some shaky cam, good old shaky cam. This was during the height of the shaky cam craze, and just kind of has this genuine, general frenetic feel about it, which can
super
be a good
colors.
Thing.
Yeah.
For some movies, I don't know that it's a good thing here.
No, I that there
now
there is a disconnect. This is the best part of the movie.
I feel it's important that throughout this film, because we're going to dog it for the most part. Spoiler alert: we're gonna be very harsh on this film.
We're gonna be harsh on this critically reviled film.
I think it's important, though. However, to call out good things when they are there.
Yes,
and thus this opening scene. Or not really opening scene, I guess second scene in the movie after the opening montage or whatever. This is a good scene. And also, John Malkovich playing the villain of Colonel?
Yeah, Colonel Quentin Turnbull.
Colonel Quentin Turnbull is also very good. So two good things here early in the film. Take note.
Yes. Right away, we're established with the fact that the cast in this movie is really, really good, actually.
Better than it deserves.
Absolutely. No, as I was taking notes for this show and getting prepared for what I was going to say for the strengths and things that I ultimately think work in this movie, the cast is among those. I mean, Josh Brolin is a natural fit for Jonah Hex. I think we all thought that from the minute this movie was announced. I remember us talking about it, that was perfect casting. Josh Brolin has been in Westerns before.
Why do this effect, Greg? It just doesn't make any sense. It's a bad effect. We've gone from live action to bad CGI and weird, cheap-looking animation. Why not just show what happens to Jonah? Makes no sense here.
No, and it's the first of what will become many missteps in this. And it also sets up, in that sequence, we see the biggest misstep, in my opinion, from the jump here, which is that they're not confident in making a Western, just a straight-up Western. So they feel like they have to go big with it. No, 2010, people aren't going to buy. It's an attraction-based business, pal. People aren't going to buy the attraction of a Western, so we need to spruce it up. We need to, superheroes are in vogue. We need to give Jonah Hex, a character who doesn't have any powers in the comics, we need to give him a superpower, some kind of a hook. And so their hook for Jonah Hex in this movie is that some Native Americans give him some magic potions while he's almost dead at the hands of Quentin Turnbull. And when he reanimates... Or when he comes out of his coma, he now has the ability to talk to the dead. However, he has to actually physically touch a dead body and reanimate it and bring it back to life. Not only does this allow him to talk to this dead person, it also allows him to have a fist fight with the dead person if need be. Why would he need to do that, you might ask? Well, it comes up later in the movie. This is a huge misstep. A, it's a stupid power for Jonah Hex to have. There's no reason for him to have it, really. B, it's incredibly inconsistent on how it works. Like, the souls are brought back from hell, the body is back to normal, but they start burning away when he touches them, but they're already dead and burning in hell anyway. So what does it matter if they turn to dust again? Like, I never quite got that. I don't think it's smart to give Jonah Hex superpowers. I also don't think it's necessary to give Jonah Hex superpowers. So I think that was just a big misstep, Nick, and a sign that they were not confident in the property that they were adapting.
I would agree. My limited knowledge of Jonah Hex, I know that he has often had supernatural elements introduced. Oh, my God. Good Lord. We've skipped a bit ahead here, folks, and right now we are seeing him with horse-mounted machine guns mowing down people. That's neither here nor there. I know that there have often been supernatural elements in Jonah Hex stories, but not often supernatural elements that come directly from Hex himself. And so this does feel like a weird fit and like you said, a bit of a misstep in terms of capturing what the character is all about. But I think there's a bigger one that we're going to discuss here pretty soon.
Yeah, it's to me, Jonah Hex doesn't need superpowers. The idea of Jonah is that he is this Clint Eastwood archetype. He is Batman in the Old West in a lot of ways. Just, you know, this vigilante, this bounty hunter who goes out and, you know, he's vulnerable. He's, you know, he's prone to being killed or taken out at any moment. He doesn't need superpowers. The fun in Jonah Hex's supernatural comics is how Jonah Hex interacts with the supernatural. And how he responds to the supernatural. Sort of like Batman, you know. He himself has no powers, but it's how he reacts to those powers that's interesting. So, and yeah, you mentioned the horse-mounted machine guns. That's actually another subplot in the movie that that kind of worked for me to a degree, is Jonah has this weapons salesman that is played by the guy from John Wick, who is the hotel manager. And I apologize. I can't think of that guy's name right now. I'm trying to look it up in the cast list here. Lance Reddick is his name, and he is known as Sharon in the John Wick movies. So he provides all this kind of James Bond. He's the Q of Jonah Hex, essentially. Provides all this weird, ahead of its time weaponry for the mid 1800s. So. That plays a role later, and there's a really cheesy scene involving Smith at the end of the movie, Nick, that character, the weapon salesman, where he and his son are watching the explosions at the end of the movie and celebrating the 4th of July in very corny fashion. The movie goes out of its way to sort of explain why Jonah is a good guy, even though he was a Confederate soldier. They go into that throughout the movie, that his conscience gets the better of him and things like that, and he's really a man with no country. But the good stuff in this movie, we've almost gotten out of the way now. There's some other stuff that pops up.
There are some other things that pop up in the course of this
yes.
movie.
And we're about to get into one of the biggest, another misstep that I think is the one you were referring to, because Quentin Turnbull is not just an evil Confederate general. He's not just a bad guy who killed Jonah Hex's family in front of his eyes, which, by the way, is another issue with this movie, but they needed much more time added onto it to let these characters and these scenes breathe a little bit. I would have liked to have seen more of that scene. I would have liked to have seen more of Jonah dealing with that, but we don't get that. So, no, it's not enough for Turnbull to just be a bad guy that's out for power or wealth or something like that. No, Quentin Turnbull...
Or just be a bad dude that did something wrong to Jonah Hex, and now Jonah's going to take revenge on him.
Right. Instead, because then you could just have a Western revenge flick. Imagine that. Jonah Hex out for revenge. That's not enough of a hook, apparently. Instead, Quentin Turnbull and his band of merry men are out to destroy America. No, I don't mean destroy the concept of America. Mm-mm. I don't mean destroy the fundamental beliefs of Americans. I mean they want to literally destroy the continent of North America with bombs. But they don't have enough bombs to do it, you see. Bombs themselves won't do it. They need something extra nation-killing weapon, they call it. And luckily, cotton gin inventor Eli Whitney has developed just what we're looking for, Nick.
Yes.
In the form of the Dragon Balls.
I was about to say, in the form of the Dragon Balls. If you get them all, it grants you a wish, and then Turnbull can wish to destroy the nation. So that's seemingly the concept here. Now, I never really understood what they did. So, like, the orange balls just explode really hard? Is that the...
No, I think that they shoot these cannonballs out into the cities that they're going after, mm-hmm. and when the cannonballs land, the orange glowing Dragon Balls are then shot after the cannonballs, and what happens is the orange balls are the detonation devices. So, like, when the orange balls combust, it causes the previously shot cannonballs to also combust.
Mm. I don't get it.
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Why is this powerful enough to destroy a nation? I don't understand.
Turnbull says, at the end of the movie, tells them to fire first, and they're firing just the cannonballs. And he goes, fire the detonation devices, or the detonators, or whatever he calls them, and they're the glowing orange Dragon Balls that fly out and cause everything to blow up. And apparently we're told that this is enough mass destruction that it could level the entire country when they're done with it.
Yep.
So they start with Washington, D.C., of course. This doesn't make any sense, obviously. We just talked about the weapon itself doesn't make any sense. Why the hell would Eli Whitney have developed these glowing orange balls that would have been locked in a vault for 10 years at this point?
No one knows, Greg. No one knows the answer. But of course, when faced with a threat such as this, the only thing to do is to deputize Jonah Hex to save the country. And this,
right,
Greg, is where I think the movie completely loses its rails. Not because of any one scene, not because of any one performance, but because of a fundamental flaw in the concept of this film. Jonah Hex, to me, again, based on limited knowledge, is a character much like Batman or the Green Arrow or other street-level characters, where I think they are at their most fascinating when the stories are small in scope, when the plot is personal in nature, and when they are not being dependent upon to literally save the universe from a massive physical threat. That is not what I find interesting about these characters. These characters are driven by guilt and by emotion and by pathos. And I to take Jonah Hex and what should have been a straightforward, this man killed my family, so now I'm going to kill him movie, and turn it into Jonah Hex coming to the defense of his country, misses the point of the character so badly and so wildly that I don't know that there was a way to come back from that creative decision, because that creative decision influences the entire plot of the movie that follows. The next hour and 10 minutes are influenced by this Jonah Hex as Defender of America storyline that just is never going to work for me, no matter what context you put it in, I think.
Interesting. So it sounds to me like you're in the camp right now that you think you're going to go with forget it with this movie.
I mean,
there's no way to solve it.
It's tricky because this fix it or forget it concept can get very, like, am I required to keep most of the aspects of this movie and try to fix it? Then you know, that's going to be very difficult. But if you can just say, hey, would a Jonah Hex movie work, and I can kind of form, you know, let that take whatever shape I think it should have taken, then absolutely a Jonah Hex movie could work.
Oh, sure, yeah.
This no Jonah Hex movie, using this take on the character and this plot, was never going to work.
I'm actually going to fall on the side of...
Sorry.
Fix it. Yes, we are being introduced to Lila Black, who we later find out is actually Tallulah Black, who is a great character from the comics, played by Megan Fox in this movie. In the comics, Tallulah Black was invented by Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti during their years-long Jonah Hex run. I encountered her through the comic All-Star Western and really enjoyed her. Now, she's much different in the comics. She's had her left eye taken out. She's horribly scarred. Megan Fox is not horribly scarred.
No.
But I will say this. One of the things that I talked about with the cast of this movie, Nick, I actually, you know, I think she's pretty good in this movie. She gets a lot of crap and got a lot of crap at that time. But, you know, obviously, you know, she's attractive. But she adds a little bit of grit to the character at the end of the movie. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is they're locked up on this ship, Turnbull's ship, at the end of the movie, and they're both chained up, and she actually escapes and helps Jonah escape, and then they tear through that crew, and she gets some pretty cool action scenes. So, you know, again, part of this killer cast. Michael Fassbender is in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He plays the heavy for Turnbull. Will Arnett is in this movie as a pompous Union lieutenant. I should say, Lieutenant Grass. Michael Shannon is briefly in this movie. Wes Bentley is briefly in this movie. And I mentioned Lance Reddick earlier. Now, there's this movie, like, there's a point in this movie, Nick, where I almost was willing to say, this isn't as bad as I remembered. And then the last 5 minutes happen, and it's the worst last 5 minutes, or at least as bad of a last 5 minutes of a comic book movie that I've ever seen. We get a final fight scene that consists of the action jumping quickly between three simultaneous scenes. Megan Fox fighting some random dude on the ship.
I thought it was Fassbender.
No, Fassbender was dead by this point.
Oh, yeah.
Fassbender had already been killed. Jonah fighting Quentin Turnbull on the ship, and Jonah fighting Quentin Turnbull in a fantasy sequence that ties to a scene earlier in the movie that makes no sense at all. So, yes, while he's fighting, physically fighting Quentin Turnbull, in his fantasy sequence, he's fighting Quentin Turnbull with guns, with a giant red sky for some reason. Mm-hmm. So it just doesn't make any sense, Nick, and that's terrible. Then once that whole thing finishes and we get the end of Quentin Turnbull, when Jonah goes back to D.C., the president, Ulysses S. Grant, offers to make him the
Sheriff of America. I don't reckon countries need sheriffs.
Wasn't, I guess that's kind of like Stone Cold Steve Austin when he was the sheriff of Monday Night Raw.
Manning when he was the sheriff.
I call him the sheriff.
Apparently the WWE needs sheriffs and the NFL needs sheriffs, but America don't need no sheriff.
Don't need no sheriff.
Oh my God.
Then he walks off with Megan Fox's Tallulah Black at the end of the movie, or seemingly at the end of the movie. They walk off together, but then she's never seen again. And he's back at the gravesite in South Carolina where his buddy was buried. And he rides off with his dog. Where's Megan Fox?
She went back to whoring.
I guess she went back to whoring. She's a prostitute, you see. But
a
no,
streetwalker. That means she's a prostitute under my employ.
So the interesting thing here, Nick, is I'm going to still fall on the side of fix it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to fix here.
Yeah.
Now,
okay, so wait. So you are suggesting that you can make this movie good, yes, and it be American hero Jonah Hex?
Yes.
All right.
Now, will it be as good as it could have been? No. However, there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot to fix here. The first thing that you've got to fix here, because there's some good things. The costumes are good. The weaponry's kind of okay. The fights are pretty good. There's a lot to fix, though. The first thing that you have to fix is the length of the movie. So the runtime on mine, Nick, shows an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, an hour 21, an hour 21 minutes. It's like an hour 21, 20 or something like that.
And that's including credits.
Yes, so probably an hour and 13 to an hour and 15 minutes.
I mean, I can't think of a single
Walking Tall.
Walking Tall is the best example. Walking Tall was a good movie that was way too short. But it is really hard to tell. Walking Tall is also telling a very simple story.
Which I would argue this, like, if this movie were telling the story it should have told, an hour and 20 minutes would have been fine. Trying to tell the story they are telling in an hour and 20 minutes is a bit of an issue.
Yeah. I still think an hour 13 to 14 of screen time is too little for getting you emotionally invested in these characters. I would like to see it at that hour and a half, you know, at least an hour and a half. I think an hour and a half is a good time for a movie. So that would give you a chance to get a little bit more time with Jonah, maybe before his family gets killed, a little bit more time, you know, to understand Tallulah Black, certainly, who's very underdeveloped. Well, the character is very underdeveloped in this movie. But the
I see what you did there.
But no, and Jonah's underdeveloped a little bit, but he's you know, the only character that exists really in the movie. Everybody else is a caricature largely. I think you have to fix that. Another thing that you have to fix in this movie that's on a more micro level, obviously, but the music. How god awful is the music in this movie?
I think I blocked it out mostly.
It's so it is like Crank. It's this weird, like, techno, heavy metal kind of music going on in the background throughout this entire picture. It doesn't fit the Old West at all. In fact, I mentioned that there's this big sort of dichotomy for me in the movie. Go ahead, Nick.
It speaks to the larger problem. I mean, they don't want the music to fit the Old West. They don't want it to have that moody, atmospheric kind of feel you'd probably want it to have, because they aren't really interested in making a Western revenge movie, which is what it should have been. And thus they choose cheesy generic metal songs for the soundtrack because they want it at its core to be a cheesy generic metal movie with some Western trappings about it.
Yeah, to be set in the Old West, right. So, but I think you change the music, you make it more appropriate. You focus more on the style that we see at the beginning of the movie, which is more of a traditional Western. Something like Hang 'Em High or something like Unforgiven, something like that. With that general approach, Josie Wales, you know, Josie Wales is probably the best comparison to Jonah Hex anyway. But that sort of an approach to filmmaking, focus on that and less on the over-the-top stuff. I think the – now here's where it gets dicey with this whole concept, Nick. I don't see any way that this director works. I think you have to get another director in there,
How many changes are allowed in this fixing of it scenario?
Well, like I said, this is a pilot, Nick. We're shooting.
Because if you're saying we can fix whatever we want, then I'm making it a straight up revenge thriller, and that's it. And now it's fixed, in my opinion.
The reason I say that, the cinematography, everything's too dark. The editing is really bad. So again, maybe if you had longer length, the editing would be better. The action scenes themselves are too dark at times. No, I would cut out all the supernatural stuff. Jonah doesn't need powers. You can cut that out of the movie easily. You could easily cut out the. I guess if you have to keep the glowing Dragon Balls, you know, it's a challenge. No. But I think I can work with that.
Why?
You don't need them. You don't need them. You absolutely don't need them. But, you know, if I'm sticking with the concept that Turnbull wants to destroy America, he has some kind of futuristic weaponry. It's a regrettable decision that Eli Whitney invented this futuristic weaponry.
John Malkovich explains to us the history of Eli Whitney at one point in the movie. Literally, he's, you know, Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. Then he came under the employ of the U.S. government building weapons of war.
Including these glowing orange balls. See, this is what it should have been. It should have been 30 minutes of Jonah Hex fashioning weapons and looking angry, mm-hmm. like he's ready to murder somebody. Tom Wopat's in this movie. We didn't even mention him. One of the Duke boys.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and here's my biggest thing that I think in all caps, be a Western. That's the biggest way to fix this movie. You have to be a Western. Embrace your character. Do what you have. I would keep the cast the same. Keep the cast. Keep the costumes. Keep even the general. I'm okay keeping the general idea behind the plot. But gosh almighty, you got to fix this stuff. You got to develop Tallulah more. Again, with more running time, you can develop her character and give her more of a reason to be there than just to be the damsel in distress. You know, Turnbull's great. I mean, I would keep all the Turnbull individual scenes the same, except for him explaining Eli Whitney. And
hell, I would have more Turnbull. Like, have him... You know, essentially have him on the run from Jonah Hex and have, you know, Hex just narrowly miss him like three or four times throughout the movie and then finally get him near the end. Like, it's, you know, more of that, more of this interplay rather than them only really having three or four scenes together.
I even like the idea that the movie goes with of Turnbull having faked his own death at one point and then Jonah finding out that Turnbull's still alive. I think that's a good idea. I just wouldn't go with the whole... Or even if he's deputized by his government, I'm okay with that. If he's deputized to bring Turnbull to justice,
yeah, not to save the country
from this evil plot that
the country admits he doesn't care about.
Right, you could completely do away with the Dragon Balls plot, and you could have the government out to get Turnbull because he's a Confederate general that never faced justice. So Jonah, in other words, is deputized to go hunt down Turnbull, and of course the conflict with the government arises in that they want Turnbull alive so he can be tried, and Jonah's going to kill him when he finds him, so, or at least try to. So that's where your conflict arises. So basically we're rewriting the movie as we're talking, but and the more I think about it, Nick, maybe that's what this show should be. As we're kind of spitballing it, instead of being fix it or forget it, maybe we just come up with ways to can we fix bad comic book movies. Watch them and come up with ways to fix them. I like that even better. What do you think, Nick?
Oh, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. So I don't know. So I think right away you've taken the elements of this movie that work, which is the very few times that it actually tries to be a Western, and the cast, which is largely very good. Even Michael Fassbender, he's really good, but his character is very strange. But, you know, that's okay. I can live with
one note, not really. He's just there to be a heavy, essentially.
Yeah, I can live with that, though. I mean, there's a lot of that in Jonah Hex comics. So I do wish that there were, as I mentioned earlier, time for some of these characters to develop. Jonah to have some moments of reflection in the movie would be cool. This is a really weird scene, Nick. Really,
I have no idea what the purpose of this scene is.
Why is there a snake man?
I don't know.
There's this fighting pit being operated by one of the Duke boys. Is that Bo or Luke?
Michael Shannon was also the announcer there.
He was the announcer, yes. So Tom Wopat, one of the Duke boys, is running this ring, and he's a former colonel that is one of the guys who betrayed Jonah at the end of the war. And I don't really understand the point of this scene entirely, other than him trying to get information on where Turnbull is. You think it's leading in one direction, and it doesn't lead in. You think, oh, well, Jonah's going to have to fight this snake man. No, Jonah doesn't have to fight the snake man. The snake man kills Tom Wopat. Not the character, the actor. Tom Wopat was killed in this scene by the snake man. For some reason, there's a Frankensteiner, by the way. Did you see that Frankensteiner, Nick?
Did.
Pretty good.
I did. Good form there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for some reason, in order to motivate the snake man to become a better fighter, they have to pour snake venom into his mouth. And it makes
him because he's the snake man.
A dangerous fighter. So
he's the goddamn snake man.
He's got to be the goddamn snake man. But yeah, this goes back into that. I would severely limit the supernatural stuff. If you want to get weird in the second Jonah Hex movie, I'm cool with that. If you want to go way out there and do how does Jonah interact with these weird mutants and whatever the hell else, that's fine. But I think for your first movie, you need to establish who the hell Jonah Hex is, why people should care about him, why people should care about his world. And I think the best way to go about that
a narrow focused approach that yes. keeps it simple from a plot standpoint.
Something where you can, identify with character, which gets to another thing that you and I have talked a lot of times that both of us kind of think that the rating thing gets overblown at times in movies. Like movies, you know, a lot of movies don't need an R rating to get their point across. Batman, for instance, The Dark Knight is fine not being an R-rated movie. Mm-hmm. And it's still dark and gritty and violent. This is a movie, I would argue, Nick, really needs to be R-rated. The character of Jonah Hex, at least in the modern era, has largely been featured in mature-rated titles, for at least in the 90s and into the 2000s, was featured in adult-oriented titles. And even in the books in the New 52, the All-Star Western book, it deals with prostitution, it deals with inbreeding, it deals with all kinds of things that you wouldn't necessarily think is kid-friendly concepts. And there's scenes in this movie that I was waiting for, like where he crushes Turnbull's head, where he there's a scene early in the movie when he rips a guy's he rips a guy's throat out at one point, but you don't see any of it. It's all off screen, and there's no blood splatter or anything. And so, at the risk of sounding like a sadist, I think that this is a movie where they should have leaned into that. They should have leaned into the grittiness and the grime, because again, Jonah Hex is not. This is not a movie that was ever going to be a big hit with kids. I don't think kids aren't lining up at the door to go see westerns.
Nope.
So this westerns are aimed, at least in the modern era, are aimed at an adult audience. So I think you lean into that and you show us a little more of Jonah being that bad dude that everybody says he is.
Absolutely agree, but that was not the movie they wanted to make for whatever reason.
Indeed not. And the other thing you notice about this, Nick, is that short runtime that we've talked about several times, it sort of shows itself in how much stuff happens so quickly. Jonah has already now gotten to the point where he reanimates Turnbull's son that Jonah apparently killed at some point. And they were best friends, and he drew on Jonah, and Jonah killed him. And this is actually a pretty good scene, if we had some sort of context for it, some sort of reason for it, for, you know, it's well acted, it's actually reasonably well written, this particular scene. It's just, A, he shouldn't be reanimating the dead in the first place, and B, if you're going to do it, give us some context for it, a reason for us to care about it going into it. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm kind of running out of things to say about
this movie.
Yeah,
I was about to say, we've aired our grievances, we've talked about how we would fix it, and now I'm just sitting here having to watch this movie again, and no, I'm over it.
Yeah, the makeup and the effects were all pretty good in this one. It's just there's so much wrong that could have been easily fixed. You mentioned that. I think that's sort of our differing here is you think that it would take so much effort to redo this movie because you'd have to lose the entire premise of Turnbull's plot on America. My standpoint is even if you have that, I think you could have still made a decent movie and still could have –
you can make a decent, competent movie, but your ceiling becomes so much lower by having it take that direction. Is my point.
I agree. Yeah, that's fair to say. Yeah, your ceiling is much lower. There's no way you could have a classic on your hands. There's no way you could even have a low level MCU level movie on your hands.
No.
With the approach that they took, I would certainly agree there. To give a little context on when we say this movie was reviled and did poorly, it managed to gross only $10.9 million at the box office on a $47 million budget.
Was that its total gross or just its opening weekend?
No, that was its total gross at the box office.
Jesus.
$10.9 million on a $47 million budget. Its critical response, it has a 12% on Rotten Tomatoes. The critical consensus reads, Josh Brolin gives it his best shot, but he can't keep the short, unfocused Jonah Hex from collapsing on the screen. Metacritic rates it a 33 out of 100. And CinemaScore, which we've talked about before, Nick, how weighted the CinemaScore is towards, most folks give movies a pass if they see them at the cinema. Well, the CinemaScore on this was a C+.
Which is abysmal.
Yes, very, very poor. Keith Phipps of the AV Club gave it a rare F rating, stating that the 81 minutes of footage that made it to the screen looked like something assembled under a tight deadline and possibly under the influence. Anyway, so this movie did not do well at all. It was a huge disaster. We think we had some ideas to fix it, but certainly, when it comes to the actual movie itself, best to forget this and move on. The terrible thing, Nick, for fans of this character, and I know there are some folks that listen to our show that are big fans of Jonah Hex, in typical WB fashion, once they fail once with a property, it takes them a while to even consider doing it again. So much like Green Lantern the next year, we have never seen them even attempt to do Jonah Hex.
This bombed at the box office. They released it the same day as Toy Story 3, directly against it. And that's not even like this year where they released like Child's Play on the same day, which was an R-rated, like very clear case of counter-programming. This was a PG-13 action movie that, in theory, you're going to try and get families to turn out to on the day that one of the biggest family films of that year was released. That makes no sense.
They really should have given it an R rating. I mean, to be honest, that's even more evidence that they should have gone with the R rating and counter-programmed Toy Story. Another huge misstep by Warner Brothers Pictures. And unfortunately, it makes it unlikely that we're going to see another Jonah Hex movie in the foreseeable future. It's hard to imagine that they would do it.
We probably won't. You're right. However, I would be heavily in favor of a Jonah Hex television property done for DC Universe or somebody in that vein.
Why not? I absolutely. And the thing is, a Jonah Hex TV show would probably be much cheaper to produce than something like Swamp Thing or Titans.
Yes.
Because you wouldn't have to lean into so heavily the effects and the supernatural kind of stuff if you didn't want to. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that's the way to go if they're going to do this property again. Anyway, give us your thoughts, folks. Was this a movie that could have been salvaged? If you have ideas for how you would have fixed this one, Shoot us those ideas on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Give us some feedback on the Place to Be Nation comics page, Place to Be Nation comics on Facebook. And also you can shoot us emails, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Let us know what you think about the new show. We're still ironing out the kinks on the format as we even do it. It was kind of a last-minute idea. Do you have any ideas for movies you'd like us to approach this with? Do you have any challenges for us of how we can fix a movie? Let us know. We'll give it a shot at how we can fix some of these properties that have traditionally been cumbersome on the big screen.
If we do Fantastic Four at some point, you'll just say there's no way to fix it because it's about the Fantastic Four.
We'll have to, you know, that's a good tease for people to see, because I believe that one of the movies we are going to do is the Josh Trank Fantastic Four film. So we'll approach that when the time comes. And until then, we're going to take a break. And when we come back on the other side, we have got Reading, Watching, and the Rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. I don't know how good that was or not, Nick. I couldn't tell.
I don't know.
Nonetheless, we are live at Ho Ho Loon Plaza in the L-shaped studio. And before we get any further into the show, we want to let you know about what a wild and crazy week it's been here at Place to Be Nation. And I want to start by telling you what's going on over at the Place to Be Nation pop feed. I'm sorry, let me repeat that. Place to Be Nation pop. First of all, the Sarcastic Four continue their look at 1971 with the third of their three-part series on Marvel Age on 1971, Nick. Good stuff, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. Lots of fun. Wrapped up that year, gave out some year-end awards, and moving on to 1972.
Jennifer Smith welcomes Tim Capel to the Freak Out Drive-In, yeah, with the live watch of Lake Placid. The hard-traveling fanboys is us. You can check out our view of Kraven's Last Hunt last week, right here on the feed. DC4U dives into the monthly current events, including announcements from Comic-Con regarding the DC universe and other things. Pop Goes the Movies, when Andy and Jennifer break down Spider-Man Far From Home and then look to the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Jason and Andy pay tribute to the rock and alternative albums of 1994 in a special edition pod. Andy Atherton rides solo in the latest Pop Goes the Movies with a review of the new Lion King remake. So two Pop Goes the Movies. And furthermore, continuing on from where I just was and lost my place, the Greatest Song of the 80s tournament continues. That's right, it was the decade of decadence. And there will be six polls a day posted for round one. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and liking the page. Be sure to weigh in, and if you're having trouble finding it, just look for some of Todd Weber's slander that he is spreading about the Georgia Satellites and their hit, Keep Your Hands to Yourself.
Wait. Explain?
Todd has said that noise in my background there was very odd. Todd has said that the Georgia Satellites' Keep Your Hands to Yourself is lowest common denominator.
Oh, for God's sake.
Not a fan of the Satellites, apparently.
Well, I'm sure they should take the Georgia Satellites off and put another U2 song on there, according to Todd.
I don't know. I'm just saying. What's going on over at the wrestling feed, Nick?
Oh, I don't even know. A bunch of things, Greg. Benzani welcomes indie wrestler Jaden Newman to Row 1, Seat 1. No Holds Barred is back. Aaron and JT return with a GWWE:PPV/TV match ever focused episode. So that's probably thrilling. In the latest episode of the PTB podcast, JT Scott and John D'Amato break down Survivor Series from 1989. And don't miss the pilot episode of a new ECW-focused podcast entitled PTBN Extreme Three-Way Dance, where hosts JT Rosero, Jennifer Smith, and John D'Amato review the concept of the show and what is to come. And over
Nick,
on,
have you ever had an extreme three-way dance?
No, I have not. No, I have not. On PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 is off and running with a brand new piece on Woodstock 1994, as well as a piece where JT looks back at Bob Backlund challenging Bret Hart for the WWE title. I know you're a big fan of that.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn's Weekly Walk, I have mentioned it. And of course, check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE, PPV, and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Welcome to the Rundown. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. It's time to get to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment
that we like to call the Rundown. This is Manager Todd. Due to audio difficulties, I will be jumping in and providing some context before Greg comes back. First up in the Rundown, Alan Moore has again distanced himself from the Watchmen project.
Publicly, in opposition to this, as he does anytime anyone does anything with Watchmen or any of his properties. And Damon Lindelof, the creator of this HBO sequel, has responded. Do you care to listen to Mr. Lindelof's response, Nick?
Not especially, but I feel you're going to tell me anyway.
I am. Lindelof says Moore, who is notoriously disapproving of adaptations of his comic book work into other media, will simply have to deal with the show whether he likes it or not. Quote, it's an ongoing wrestling match. He says this to Deadline. Lindelof says he feels he's channeling Alan Moore's punk rock spirit by saying, fuck you guys, I'm doing it anyway. As for its relation to the original Watchmen, Lindelof says they're building on the alt history of Moore's world with an America where Robert Redford is president, superheroes are outlaws, and racial tensions between masked police and citizens are stronger than ever. What in 2019 is the equivalent of the nuclear standoff between the Americans and the Russians? It is the race and the police. It is race and the police, sorry. I'm not sure what Sting and his group have to do with this, but nonetheless. He also says they will be offering no concrete solutions to these complex, multi-layered issues. So, on the one hand, I kind of get it, what he's saying here. You know, Alan Moore, you know, at this point, he's not going to approve of. You could write the greatest movie of all time about Watchmen, and he's not going to approve of it. And I also kind of get the idea of updating it to reflect racial tensions and things of that nature. I just don't understand the need or the purpose of doing that with Watchmen. Watchmen was about a specific thing. And while I think you can change that, as we're seeing in Doomsday Clock, to very great acclaim, and it's possible that Lindelof could do the same, nothing about this project so far gives me hope that it will be as subtle and effective as Watchmen was with what it was doing, and work on multiple levels. Because Watchmen doesn't just work as a political satire. It doesn't just work as a critique of the medium of comic books. It also works as a straightforward story, if you choose to view it that way. So, I don't know. I have huge concerns with this, Nick. What about you?
Yeah, same. And plus, it doesn't help that Lindelof comes off like a combative douche. I understand that Moore is difficult to get along with and is going to be down on everything, but openly taking that stance in public is not exactly the best way to endear yourself to a fan base that is already skeptical, I would say.
Yes, I agree. We've seen in the past, whether it was Darwin Cook, whether it was Jeff Johns, whether it was some of the other creators that worked on before Watchmen, for instance, Zack Snyder on his movie. And I can't remember any of them taking this blatant of a defiant, primarily young, primarily male, primarily defiant approach to Moore in going. And maybe, you know, fighting back against Alan Moore probably needs to happen. But I also think that you're dealing with a book that is not just revered, but a book that is revered for good reason. Like, this is one of those books that people, not everybody, but I think most people in our group anyway that have read it would agree, even though we don't agree on everything by any means in comic books, we all kind of agree this is a sacred cow. And, you know, it's something that if you're going to do, you need to do it carefully, and you need to do it very you need to be very careful with how you approach it. And maybe this will end up being great. I don't know. But so far, I got to make the confused, uncertain noise of, Well, appropriately for Watchmen, though, Robert Redford will be the president, and he will be played by Robert Redford. So Robert Redford's acting retirement did not last very long, as he appeared briefly in Avengers Endgame and now will be once again coming out of retirement to play a fictional version of himself as the President of the United States. He won the U.S. presidential election in 1992 and is still the president in 2019, the setting of the Watchmen TV show. So, thoughts on this, Nick?
That's actually pretty cool.
Yes, I agree.
And I have to imagine, I know they, you know, in the comic that was the future canon is that he would become president or whatever, but I have to imagine he wouldn't do this unless he believed in the script at least. So maybe that's a sign of encouragement that we can take out of this.
Perhaps so. But another sign of encouragement is the movement that we've seen recently in the Venom sequel. We were just talking on these airwaves last week and the week before, I believe, about how this Venom sequel, nothing's come out about it. Despite the success of the film at the box office, we were expecting to hear something about a Venom sequel pretty quickly, and it's kind of been floating around there for a bit. Well, latest news is that they are searching for a director for Venom 2, and they have reportedly narrowed it down, according to Variety, to three candidates. These three candidates are Andy Serkis, Travis Knight, and Rupert Wyatt. So Andy Serkis, people will most know for as being an actor. He's been in the MCU as Ulysses Klaw. He has, of course, he's the famous CGI motion capture actor for Gollum, for the Planet of the Apes movies, for all kinds of stuff. He's a genius performer. Not a lot in the directing realm yet, so that's kind of interesting. Travis Knight is best known for directing Paramount's Bumblebee film. And finally, Rupert Wyatt, who is known for directing Rise of the Planet of the Apes, a very good movie. Honestly, any of these options sound good to me, Nick. I'm pretty pumped about this. I know I enjoyed the first Venom movie more than a lot of people did, and for its over-the-topness and everything else. And the sequel has a lot of potential. Of these candidates, who are you hoping for?
You know, I don't really have a preference. I don't know much about. I haven't seen any of those Modern Apes movies, so I can't speak with any great conviction about Rupert Wyatt. But I know Andy Serkis has gotten an increased reputation in Hollywood, and I would think that Venom is going to involve a lot of motion capture. So, who better to kind of take that on than the king of motion capture?
Mm-hmm. That would be certainly an interesting approach. I haven't seen Bumblebee yet, so I don't feel confident.
Yeah, me neither.
Talking about Travis Knight, I've heard that was a very good movie. Of these, I think Rupert Wyatt would probably be the most interesting one to me, but certainly any of them would be unique and probably a step up from what we got in the first one. So hopefully this continues to develop, quite frankly. Now, speaking of continuing to develop, Nick, The Walking Dead just continues to expand in many, many directions on television. AMC has announced a new Walking Dead series coming in 2020, currently titled The Walking Dead. I don't necessarily read it that way, Nick. I don't think you do either. The article says it's currently titled The Walking Dead, but that's the same title as the main series, so I don't necessarily know that that's the case. But anyway, they released a teaser for it, and it seems to indicate that it will focus on a new world of The Walking Dead. Characters dealing with a new – and it's got some pretty interesting and weird imagery going on in some concept art that is included in this teaser. I don't really know what to make of this, Nick. Do you have any theories on what this could be?
Not really. I mean, the concept of the show does sound a little bit interesting. I've read that it's going to involve a group of adolescents who kind of grew up in an area that wasn't really as hard hit by the outbreak as others and have kind of been kind of sheltered for most of their lives. And then they kind of set off from their homestead and wound up encountering this world they're completely unfamiliar with and also, you know, kind of growing into adulthood during that. So it's an interesting concept, but as I've said before, I'm done with Walking Dead, so I won't be watching it.
Is it purported, I wonder, to take place in the future at all? Maybe what becomes far distant future of The Walking Dead? I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. I agree that's somewhat compelling. It'll be interesting to
see.
Even
though you hate kids.
Oh, no. If they're too young, I won't be interested, as you know. If they're late teens, maybe. But if they're like, you know, early teens, mid teens, nah, not interested. Not as interesting. Plus, I figure if it's a Walking Dead show, they're all going to be tortured and punished a lot. So, you know, if they are teenagers, they probably have it coming. So, I don't know. I'll keep an eye on it. I've enjoyed the main show the last bit. So maybe I'll enjoy this one as well. I don't know. Of course, I said I was going to watch Fear the Walking Dead when Morgan went over there, and I still haven't. So I probably won't watch it. Well, what's left here? We've got one more story left, and that is sort of a what-if situation, Nick. And I got to be honest, this was a what-if that somewhat bummed me out.
Yeah, me too when I read it.
We have an update on the now-canceled Ben Affleck version of the Batman. The cinematographer for Affleck's now-canceled The Batman talked on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast about this movie that was going to happen and then didn't. His name is Robert Richardson. He also worked with Affleck on Live by Night. He said they were getting ready to shoot the movie. There was a script, but it wasn't a loved script. And there was a lot of work that Affleck was doing on this script to sort of doctor it up for the studio. But what Richardson says is that the movie was going to focus on insanity, the nature of insanity. It was going to be heavily focused on Arkham Asylum, that Batman was going into Arkham, a place where everyone is bad, everyone is messed up. And Arkham Asylum had never been done in live-action films previously, which is one of the reasons why they really wanted to delve into this. He said he was very interested in that. He ended up moving on to be the director of photography for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for Quentin Tarantino. So it worked out okay for Richardson. But I got to be honest, Nick, not that I'm not interested in what we're going to get with the Batman moving forward, because I am. But this kind of bummed me out because I kind of liked Affleck's Batman, and we've never gotten Arkham on the big screen.
And this approach to telling a Batman story sounds a little different. Like, it sounds like it's going to be mm-hmm. largely focused on one location and being... I mean, that premise sounds more psychologically driven than any Batman film we've seen to date, to include even some of the ones that attempt to, which, like, Batman Forever attempts to be very psychologically driven whenever it comes to the character of Bruce Wayne. Now, I would argue it fails at that, but that's neither here nor there. Dark Knight Trilogy, undoubtedly very psychologically driven, but this seems like that would be the main thrust of the movie, and thus it would be able to be a Batman movie that would be different than anything we've seen before, which is kind of, mm-hmm. that's kind of the goal here at this point, because we've seen so many different kinds of Batman movies, you don't want to just keep remaking any particular movies. Version. Yeah. So this would have been awesome.
And also,
if they couldn't crack the script, then it makes sense why they didn't do it.
It seems to maybe be influenced by Grant Morrison's Serious House on Serious Earth.
Yes, which is the only good Grant Morrison Batman story, by the way.
Not the only good one.
It's the only good one.
You liked that Joker Pro story that he did?
That's true.
Anyway. And Batman and Robin was good for a while.
In your opinion.
That's why I said it. In any event, that's all for the rundown. Like I said, lighter week this week. So let's move on to watching. What you be watching?
What you be watching? Are you happy? Nick? We didn't call it reading and watching. You happy out there? Is Twitter happy?
Oh, Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, Nick, have you not? Well, this really isn't speaking of Twitter at all. That was a bad transition. Have you watched anything this week, comic book related?
No, but I have been playing something. I have been playing a mess of a whole ass load of Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3, and it is excellent. It is, as we discussed, Greg, leading up to the game's release, I was most concerned that because it was being taken over by a different studio. That it would not play like the old Activision games. I'm happy to report the game mechanics are very similar. The game itself plays almost identically to the old Marvel Ultimate Alliance games. The only problem is the difficulty factor has been ramped up considerably. I am playing on friendly difficulty, which is supposed to be the easiest setting in the game, and I am routinely getting my ass whipped by the computer. Only about 5 or 6 levels into the game. I have read that the developers actually intended for the difficulty level to be significantly increased because they want you to have incentive to replay levels. They want you to go back and grind your characters to level them up so that you can progress through the game, which was not something I had foreseen coming in. So, difficulty issues aside, excellent, excellent game. A lot of fun thus far.
Great. I would love to play it, except it's not available on the PlayStation. So I'll have to wait for it to come out on that or until I visit you again.
Mm-hmm.
You're sorry ass. Well, I've been watching some comic book things, if you'd care to hear about them.
I would.
Well, I have viewed another episode of Supergirl, which puts me one step closer to the finale. I am now 2 episodes away from the end of the season of Supergirl. I watched this on Netflix. I highly recommend Netflix versions of these shows. The decrease in advertising is tremendous, and it was a good episode. It was things are really ramping up. Supergirl has now, for the very first time, learned the truth about who this red daughter is. They've uncovered the red daughter and the conspiracy behind that, and Benjamin Lockwood has given himself superpowers. But alienated his son in the process. A lot of interesting moving parts here. It's really starting to come together, I think, in a major way. Jean is back from Mars. A loud motorcycle just drove by, and there's just a lot of good stuff going on here. I continue to not be as invested as they probably want me to be in what I can only assume is a budding romance between James Olsen's sister. And
Alex.
Alex, thank you. I kind of want to call her Maggie for some reason. Alex. I still feel like that sister character hasn't found a natural fit in the story yet. But that being said, the actress is pretty good, and the show around it has been very, very good. So yeah, they've stepped it back up after a couple of down episodes, and now they're picking up momentum for the finale. Happy with that.
Good to hear.
And other than that, I don't think there's anything else. I did watch a movie over the weekend. I watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I've not watched a comic book movie other than what we've talked about in this show, Jonah Hex. So with that being said, that is the end of watching. So let's move on to The Clock on the Wall.
Mm.
Grandfather clock, in fact, Nick. I had it installed just a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the grandfather clock tells me that it's time. Once again, the wrestling minute.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, what you got for us, Nick?
Oh, I thought pretty solid week thus far. I'm drastically behind on the G1. You'll talk more about that, but from a WWE perspective, good week of shows from both Raw and SmackDown, from what I understand. So, Arrow trending up, I guess.
Would it be fair to call it good shit, pal?
I don't know if it reaches that lofty category, but it's a step in the right direction. How about that?
Yeah, I enjoyed both shows this week. I thought SmackDown had good in-ring action, good in-ring wrestling, and I thought Raw just had a really good story aspect to it. Particularly the last hour of Raw was tremendous. The first 2 hours were alternatingly, they were mostly good. I mean, I had a really good tag match with the Usos and the Revival and the OC, and a really good gauntlet match, which Ricochet came out on top of. But really, the reason I think everybody's talking about Raw right now is that last hour was, it felt like something out of 2002 or 2001, where there's a lot of shit happening and a lot of characters intermingling with one another that you wouldn't expect to intermingle with one another, and a crazy wild brawl to end the show that included a stage dive, included dudes trading off back and forth. Really good stuff. And then the Brock Lesnar violent beating of Seth Rollins was entertaining as hell and has actually made me interested in a match that I previously had zero interest in. So kudos to both of those guys for that. I don't know how Seth Rollins came out of that unscathed, assuming that he did. Other than that, yes, I have been watching the G1. I'm two nights behind now. It's so hard to keep up. I am two nights behind, but boy, there's been some outstanding wrestling. Over the weekend, I watched Will Ospreay versus Kazuchika Okada, which I think I told you guys is, to me, one of the best wrestling matches I've ever seen. It's not Okada Omega 4, but I think it was on that same level as the first Okada Omega match. It was amazing. Just one of the best that I've seen. Amazing performance from both guys. But then that's one of the best matches I've seen, but amazingly, that's not like leagues ahead of some of the other matches that I've seen. Ishii and Moxley was great. Ishii and Cobb was great. Ishii and Naito was great. So many excellent matches. John Moxley's had great matches with several opponents. He's had the best run of his career, in my opinion, from an in-ring perspective. So just really great stuff across the board. I continue to enjoy watching Kenta revive himself. He had a great match with Okada. To watch the rise of John Moxley, the rise of Lance Archer, who continues putting good performances. New Japan is really excelling at that variety approach. And by that, it's different from WWE's variety show, where they want comedy, they want, you know, they want promos, they want soap opera drama and all that stuff, which is great when it's pulled off. I think New Japan's approach to variety comes from an in-ring perspective, where you have the Yano doing a comedy wrestling match, or you have Bad Luck Fale working as a giant against people and how do they have to work around him, or you have Zack Sabre Jr. with his crazy submission wizard style, Will Ospreay with his high-flying style, Tanahashi with this old-school kind of mat wrestling approach, Okada with the big fight feel to all of his matches, Kenta with heavy strike based offense. Just so much fun to watch, Nick.
Absolutely.
And also, we got the announcement officially of AEW's first TV taping coming in October. October the, what is it, 5th?
Second.
Second, yes. October 2nd. And so far we've got a six-man tag announced with Jericho and two mystery partners against Kenny and the Young Bucks, and we've got Cody Rhodes against Sammy Guevara. What are we thinking for the mystery partners, Nick?
I have no idea. LAX was the most was the best suggestion I've seen bandied about online, just because it's seemingly reasonable, and you know, would be a semi big pull for them at this point. So I don't know, maybe them. I honestly have no idea though.
I have two ideas. Number one, Hall and Nash, the Outsiders. Number two, some other guy. I haven't figured out who the other guy is yet. And Tommy Merlin.
I like that one. That's a good one. That's a good one indeed. Ralphus and Tommy Merlin.
Ooh, that's really good. That is really, really good. Well, with all that being said, folks, we're going to wrap things up here. We will be back next week with a countdown of our favorite rogues galleries in comics. As you know, this was a source of contention between Nick and I on recent episodes here of the show. So we're going to bounce back and try to knock that out for you. And then from there, we've got, gosh, what else do we have coming up this month, Nick?
Oh, we've got you know, the show that is catching the comics world on fire right now is The Boys on, is it Hulu or is it?
Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime has got The Boys. So we're actually going to do a long book hunt on the first volume of that comic. So check that out at the end of the month. And then also in the month of August, we are currently slated to have a giant-sized podcast about a topic to be determined, quite frankly.
You just let us figure that out, folks.
Yes, in due time. But before we depart, we will close the show as we have been for some time now with a little musical number from WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. And, you know, Greg, you mentioned it earlier. Certain individuals in Place to Be Nation comics are casting aspersions on certain acts and certain songs. And so what better way to fight that and stump for the proper outcome in the PTBN A Greatest Song of the 80s tournament than by having good old JR put his own spin on a little tune. So, Jim, take it away.
I have got a little change in my pocket, and it's going, Jing-a-ling-a-ling. Want to call you on the telephone booth or give you a ring. Now, I'm not talking about a diamond ring. I'm not talking about one of them. I'm not talking about one of them rings that Cowboy liked to wear on his fingers on occasion. I'm not talking about one of Mr. Barnett's rings. I'm talking about a 20 by 20 squared circle. A ring where you get in there in the ring and you wrestle. None of this bullshit where you're lazy, know-nothing talents that try to be lazy and work their way outside the ring, go through the crowd, break all the rules. Of course, you can't break any rules anymore because there are no rules. How, as a heel, how are you supposed to get heat if you can't break any rules? Because there are no rules to break. You tell me, that's a mystery. But each time we talk, I get the same old thing. Always no huggy, no kissy, till I get a wedding ring. Well, my honey, my baby, don't put my love upon no shelf. She said, don't hand me no lines and keep your hands to yourself. But baby, why you want to treat me this way? You know that I am still your lover boy. I still feel the same way I always have, quite frankly. And then that's when she told me that same old story, heard 1,000 times, about free milk and a cow. And she said, no huggy, no kissy till I get a wedding vow. Well, which one is it? Do you want a ring or do you want a vow? I mean, this is the kind of bullshit, quite frankly, that we have to put up with in this business on social media. And encourage people whose nuts would fit into a thimble to come out here and make comments like this. My honey, my baby, don't put my love upon no shell. And she said, don't hand me no lines for God's sake and keep your damn hands to yourself. Go, man, go. Is instrumental interlude. Just letting it breathe for a minute. I'm working a body part, telling a story, allowing the instruments to do the job for me. Working smarter, not harder.
Oh! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh
no!
Oh! Oh! Oh!
Now, hold it here. See, I wanted her ass real bad, and I was about to give in. You could tell by some of my tweets. I was retweeting some account, including WWE P-Porn. But that's when she started talking about true love. Started talking about sin. The WCW pay-per-view sin. And I said, honey, I'll live with your ass for the rest of my life. And she said, no huggy, no kissy, till you make me your wife. For some reason, my wife turned into Triple H here. She said, till you make me your wife. My honey, my baby, don't put my love upon no shelf. She said, don't hand me no lines. And you, well, you keep your damn hands to yourself.
Our traveling fanboys.